Side 3, An Agent in Place by Robert Little, continuing on page 81. Inside the metro station, Ben pulled off one of his gloves and inserted a 5-kopeck coin in the turnstile. "Where are you taking me?" he asked Aida. "Anywhere," she murmured. Moving as if in a dream, she pushed through the turnstile. Inserting another coin, Ben pushed through after her. "Anywhere is where I will go with you," he declared with such intensity only a fool would have doubted his sincerity. As Russians racing for trains jostled past on either side, he peeled off her glove and grasped her hand in his and started to memorize it. Her fingers were long and lean and rough, her nails cut short, her knuckles chapped. On her middle finger she wore a ring of beaten silver with some kind of stone set in it. "It is agate," she answered his question before he asked it. "It is said to banish fear, but so far it has not worked." Caught in currents of Muscovites, they found themselves on a long escalator plunging into the earth. Ben descended to the step below Aida and turned to face her. Their eyes were on the same level. "What are you afraid of?" he asked. Everything around Aida seemed a blur. Only Ben remained in sharp focus. Studying his eyes, she was struck again by their feverish alertness, by their lucidity. Responding to his question, she offered an answer that had the texture, the tone, of a sigh. "I am terrified of dying," she told him, "and weary to the bone of living. I am afraid of losing poetry, of losing my son, of losing my insanity, which, in a manner of speaking, is the source of my poetry." A half-smile, saturated with pain, appeared on her face. "I am afraid of hoping, of desiring, of giving myself without holding part of myself back." Waiting for a train to pull into the station, she shivered from something other than the cold and hugged herself. Leaning against him, she pressed her lips to his ear and whispered, "I am terrified of being loved and terrified of not being loved." With Aida leading the way, they got off at the last stop and headed toward the river through a narrow park sandwiched between clusters of apartment buildings. Neither spoke. There seemed to be too much to say. They passed under the arched entrance of the maritime station and made their way down the middle of a long road, with the shadows of woods on either side, until they came to the edge of the river and the 15 or so sparkling white passenger ships tied up in twos to the pier. The ships were alive with lights, and humming with the sounds of motors and generators. The walkway was thick with ice, and the footing was precarious. They held on to each other and exchanged smiles when Aida slipped and clung to Ben's arm to keep from falling. At the end of the pier, several dozen automobiles and taxis were parked in front of a brightly lit ship, with the name Maxim Gorky printed in large block letters on the hull. Many of the cars had drivers waiting in them, and motors running so that the heaters would work. In front of the gangway, Aida turned to Ben. "Vadim is a great capitalist," she explained quickly. "He and some of his friends leased the Maxim Gorky from the state under a new law intended for farmers who want to rent land and turned it into a cooperative restaurant." She indicated the parked cars. "It has become a hangout for the new rich, the ones who, like Vadim, can squeeze money out of stone." Ben followed Aida through a door amidships into the ship's dining area. Inside the door, a blast of warm air hit them. An emaciated teenage girl, tottering about on high heels she was not accustomed to, took their coats. From somewhere beyond a thick crimson curtain came the mournful whine of a gypsy violin playing Hungarian dances. A man with a pinched face and sunken eyes of an alcoholic pushed through the curtain and seized Aida by the elbow. "You were supposed to be here at 7, he hissed. "This is Vadim," Aida started to say, but her future ex was already steering her through the curtain into the dining room. "He is waiting for you," he said under his breath. "In theory, the deal is done. He has agreed to publish a book of your poems, and I have agreed to add a sun porch to his dacha in Repino. Only I ask it of you as a friend. Be polite to him." The lighting inside the restaurant was subdued, and it took a moment before Ben could make anything out. He trailed after Aida and Vadim, past booths crammed with men and women talking in undertones. The tables were heaped with piles of steaming blinis and 2 kilo tins of black beluga caviar and bowls of cream and bottles of vodka and champagne and wine. 2 waiters in black trousers and white shirts pushed past carrying trays heaped with fruit, something Ben had only seen in the special gastronome that supplied food to diplomats. Aida reached for Ben's hand and pulled him toward a round table next to a floor-to-ceiling window in the far corner of the room. Outside, streaks of light from the docked boats skidded off the ice-covered surface of the Moscow River. A fat man with a chaplain-esque mustache on his upper lip half rose out of his chair at the sight of Aida. The woman sitting next to him, dressed in a black lace dress that exposed half her bosom, grabbed the end of his tie to keep it from falling into a bowl of cream. The fat man reached for Aida's hand and lightly grazed the back of it with his lips, which looked as if they had been rouged. "Vadim has told me a great deal about you," he confided in a silky whisper. He sank back into his chair as if the effort to get half out of it had exhausted a reserve of energy. Vadim snapped his fingers. Waiters appeared with 2 more chairs, place settings, and long-stemmed glasses filled with champagne. Vadim plunked himself down next between Ben and the publisher, grasped the stem of a glass with shaking fingers, and proposed a toast. "Now that we are all here, let us drink to private enterprise and your new publishing project." The fat man flattened his mustache with the side of a finger. "My maison d'édition is honored to be charged with the publication of the poems of the legendary Zavaskaya." "How many?" Aida challenged. The fat man cast a quick, dark glance at Vadim, then looked back at Aida. "How many what?" "How many poems are you prepared to include in the book? And how many books are you prepared to print?" Vadim groaned. The fat man said, "The number of poems in the book must depend on the length of the poems, as well as the size of the type we decide on. As for the press run, we were thinking of something in the neighborhood of 5,000. How many poems were you planning to offer us?" Smiling grimly, Aida announced her terms. 50 poems, set in 10-point type, with an appropriate amount of white space around the poems, in an edition of not less than 25,000 copies. The woman sitting next to the fat man nervously stuffed a blini into her mouth and washed it down with a mouthful of champagne. The publisher leaned back in his chair and pulled air in through enormous nostrils. His stomach seemed to bloat until it pressed against the edge of the table. 50 poems is out of the question," he said flatly. "We are a new publishing venture. Where would we get paper for an edition of 50 poems? 20, if the layout is tight, 25 even, is within the realm of possibility, in an edition of 10,000. 40 poems in an edition of 15,000 is my absolute limit," Aida said. The violinist started to draw near the table, but Vadim waved him off. "Assuming that the numbers are negotiable," he said, "what are the other stumbling blocks?" Aida caressed the stem of her champagne glass. "There is the question of the quality of the paper. There is the matter of who has the final say on the selection of the poems." The publisher's eyebrows slithered up on his forehead and remained there. He said to Vadim, "You led me to believe that I would be able to exercise editorial judgment when it came to the selection of the poems. You likewise led me to believe that Madame Zavaskaya was willing to tone down some of her more outrageous images." The stem of the champagne glass splintered between Aida's fingers as she roared, "Outrageous images!" Conversation in the dining room, the whine of the gypsy violin, broke off. Heads swiveled. Sucking on a finger from which blood trickled, Aida asked sarcastically, "So, if you consider the images in my poems so outrageous, what pushes you to publish them?" Vadim shot a look at the violinist, who immediately started playing again. The fat publisher scraped back his chair and slowly levered himself to his feet. "My dear Vadim, thank you for a most delightful supper and the great pleasure of your company. Perhaps you can iron out the details with Madame Zavaskaya, in which case we can put our heads together at a later date." Followed by his dinner companion, the publisher waddled down the aisle toward the door. Aida reached for a bowl of cream and would have flung it at his broad back if Ben had not taken hold of her wrist. Vadim started laughing. "Aida is no gentleman," he informed Ben. "Assuming you have aspirations in that direction, you will find her easier to live with if you let her act out her frustrations. Ben was amused by the whole scene. Thank you for the advice. Still shaking with anger, Aida reached for her tobacco and paper and began to roll a thin cigarette. At least you will not have to build a sun porch for the bastard, she told Vadim. A waiter reached over Aida's shoulder with a lighted match, and she sucked the cigarette into life. Eddies of dense smoke masked her face, which was still crimson with anger. Vadim edged his chair nearer to Ben's. Kneading the warts on the back of his hand, already raw from scratching, he said, I could not help but notice you speak Russian with some kind of peculiar accent. Aida said, He is an Israeli come to lead the Jews, you foremost among them, out of Russia to the promised land. For me, Vadim retorted, America, not Israel, is the promised land. He eyed Aida's new friend as if he were a potential client. Ben said, I am American. Vadim's beady eyes blazed with interest. Ah, an American, he said in English. I been to America the Beautiful once. Too many years ago, America the Beautiful is a country where people have 1.8 children per family. That's quite a feat, having 1.8 children. I myself prefer 0.0 children per family. Don't misunderstand me. I take the view that there is nothing wrong with children that not having them can't cure. He stopped talking long enough to smother a belch in his hand. I was a member of a delegation who visited your famous Madison Street. You look like a man of the world. You have probably heard of Madison Street. That's where they run ideas up flagpoles and salute them. Vadim snapped off a drunken salute as he downed the rest of his champagne. Clutching the bottle by the neck, squinting as he took aim, he sloshed more champagne into his glass, then leaned toward Ben. Among my other business interests, I happen to be in the advertising game myself, he plunged on, slurring his words, batting his bloodshot eyes, rolling his head from side to side in his eagerness to make his English understood. Only in Russia the ad game has a peculiar twist. Things which are well made are never advertised. They don't need to be. As soon as they go on sale, word spread, lines form. The item sells out in hours, even minutes. The advertising executive's job is to push the products that are badly made, that nobody will buy, even if you sell them at a gigantic discount. Listen, a week doesn't go by without me being taken to warehouses to inspect mountains of coats without buttonholes, galoshes that aren't waterproof, electric heaters without heating coils, gloves that fit only left hands, belts without buckles, bicycles without pedals, wheels with defective spokes, fishing reels that don't rewind, bottled vinegar seasoned with dead ants. If an item has no selling point, I make it sing. I try image advertising, which leaves people feeling good about the product. But in Russia, none of the techniques I learned from Madison Street work, because everyone knows that if a product is advertised, it means it is badly made and not selling. It's not as if people don't pay attention to advertisements. They pay a lot of attention. They watch advertisements in order to know what not to buy. Aida tried to interrupt. I do not think Benedict is very interested in advertising. I am not talking about advertising, Vadim insisted. I am talking about a sociological phenomenon. He scraped his chair still closer to his neighbor until their knees were touching. I got into hot water during the period of stagnation, which is our usual euphemism for the period that precedes the present, for proposing an ad campaign to sell Marxism-Leninism to the masses. I ran the idea up a flagpole, and they almost ran me up the flagpole after it. I'm not making it up. This is not alcohol inventing. It's me talking what really happened. My bosses said to me I was trying to sabotage Marxism-Leninism by advertising it, since everybody would jump at the conclusion that if it was advertised, there must be something wrong with it. The whole thing was Kafkaesque, Aida remarked. He barely talked them out of packing him off to Siberia for anti-Soviet activity. Vadim peered into Ben's face. You know the difference between a communist and an anti-communist, he demanded. A communist is someone who has read Marx and Lenin. An anti-communist is someone who has understood Marx and Lenin. Ha! You have had a long day, Aida told her husband in a comradely way. You ought to go home. But Vadim, once launched, was unstoppable. I got another idea, which is maybe worth millions, he confided to Ben with a smirk. It's a campaign to advertise the most perfect product in the universe, the vagina. You look like a man of the world. You have probably heard of the vagina. Picture it. You start with a celebrity endorsement from someone with a high Q. Maybe the first lady. Maybe the great helmsman himself. Think of the verbatims you would get back when the masses out there heard him pitching its tangy odor, its soft furriness, its bittersweet taste. Smothering a hoarse laugh in the palm of a sweaty hand, Vadim suddenly turned morose. His eyes almost disappeared into his skull. Except if the vagina was advertised, everybody would assume it was a lousy product. It could mean the end of cunnilingus in Mother Russia. Ha! Maybe what we should do is leave oral sex to word of mouth. Exploding with glee at the play on words, Vadim flailed his raw hands around his head as if he were swatting mosquitoes. Trying to follow a conversation in English makes my head spin, Aida announced after her future ex had finally stumbled off, leaning on the shoulder of the emaciated girl to keep from falling. Vadim means well. His problem is that he enjoys playing more than scoring. He likes the journey more than the getting there. He is eternally along for the ride. The dining room was beginning to empty. Calculating rates of exchange on an abacus, the emaciated girl was busy making change in dollars and pounds and francs and marks. Ben said, "It is difficult to imagine you falling in love with the Vadim I met tonight." Aida inspected the spot of coagulated blood on her finger. Like everyone else, she told him, Russians have multiple personalities. They show different faces to different people. The Vadim who pressed his face against the window and wrote in soap, "Will you marry me?" was not the Vadim you met tonight. There was a core of fearlessness, of gallantry to him back then that could not be concealed by a torrent of glib cynicism. He joined the system and reduced it to ad absurdum. It is still there, that core, but it is hidden under layers of bruises and warts, physical and mental. She ran her fingertips lightly over the back of Ben's hand, examining a childhood scar. You have not been in Russia long enough to understand that there are two realities, two sides to every personality and every situation, two sides to Russia itself. Everything is exactly as it seems, but the opposite is also true. You have heard of our poet Voznesensky. One of his better poems deals with this phenomenon. It is called Anti-Worlds. Staring off into some middle distance, she resurrected several lines. Long live anti-worlds. They rebut with dreams the rat race and the rut. Ben asked with a curious smile, Do you think there are two sides to me? Aida appeared to exchange knowing looks with the fox at the end of her neckpiece. Jung said somewhere that we are all trailed by a shadow self that is less inhibited by conventional morality than the so-called real self we present to the world. My pet fox, whom I call Pandora after the famous box which, when you opened it, had hope inside, has two sides to her. Why should you be different? Why should I, for that matter? The self I show to the world would have flung a bowl of cream at that bastard of a publisher. My shadow self, which I repress, could have plunged a knife in his back. The restaurant was empty now, except for Aida and Ben, and the waiters clearing tables and setting out fresh linen and silver. Yawning, the gypsy violinist fitted his instrument into a case, tucked it under his arm, and nibbling on a folded blini stuffed with caviar, headed for the exit. Absently fingering a knife, Aida examined a vertical stripe of her face in the blade, then turned the blade to examine the horizontal stripe of her eyes. Still looking at herself in the knife blade, she said, with sudden intensity, What you told me on the steps the other day about hoping we would never meet again. She looked suddenly at Ben. It struck me as the most honest thing any man has ever said to me. But why did you say it? What was behind it? Ben's thoughts raced. It was not too late to get to his feet and leave, but he was caught in the web of her anger, her passion, her sensuality. He could feel a lust for life radiating from the pores of her body. He wanted to push the limits of intimacy to extremes with her. He harbored the irrational desire not so much to penetrate her as to take refuge in her. Looking at her now, it was hard to imagine she had ever been young. No innocence remained, not a trace in her eyes and the melancholy half-smile that created a fan of tiny wrinkles at the corners of her mouth, in the dimple under her lower lip that trembled slightly with, what? Uncertainty? Fear? Fear of fear? Her question hung in the air between them. She was waiting for an answer. Through the snowstorm, he said finally, I caught your heart's ache. It frightened me. The skin around Aida's eyes stiffened in disappointment. I barely know you, she commented softly, but I can already tell when you are not cutting to the bone. There is more to it than that. There is more to you than meets the eye. One day you will tell me a truth as intently as you did outside the cafe. I hope I will believe you when you do. The emaciated girl brought word that because of the extreme cold, Vadim had sent his taxi back for Aida. He rented it by the year, paid whatever was on the meter at the end of every week, claimed that the arrangement was more convenient than owning an automobile and having to hunt for motor oil and gasoline and spare parts. Its engine idling, the taxi was waiting for them when they came down the gangway. Aida was surprised to find a driver she did not know behind the wheel and said so. Dmitri has the flu, the driver, who had enormous beet-red earlobes, explained. I am a friend of a friend. You trust him? Ben said in English, indicating with a flick of his head the back of the taxi driver. Aida answered in English. He is driving Vadim's taxi, she said simply. During the short ride back to Rechnoivokzal, Ben told her about his Russian roots, about his grandfather's warning that he would feel Russia pulling at him like gravity through the soles of his shoes, about majoring in Russian studies at university, about the master's thesis he wrote comparing Stalin before and after the suicide of his wife, Nadezhda. Aida asked Ben if he had ever been married, and he nodded yes. She asked him if he had any children. He nodded yes again. A boy, he said. His name is Felix. She said, you must miss him. But he only stared out the window at the branches of the trees weeping under the weight of the ice clinging to them. She touched his arm. How old is he? He was 6 in January. That makes him a Capricorn, she noted. My Sava is also a Capricorn. So am I. We are a family of Capricorns. Me, I'm an honorary Capricorn, the driver called over his shoulder. That's what the wife says. It's because I always finish what I start is why she says it. At Rechnoivokzal, the taxi pulled up in front of the door of a shabby apartment building. Aida looked up at her father's window, imagined him sitting rigid in his wicker chair, straining to see whether the car that had stopped in front of the building was filled with militiamen. Ben asked in a hushed voice, Is this where you live? Aida nodded. We have 3 rooms on the 5th floor. Can we spend the night together? Act as if I am not here, the driver said. Aida switched to English. We will spend the night together, she told him, but not this night. It would not be prudent. I share the flat with a woman whose husband's brother is a militia officer. Also, there is my son Sava. How would I explain him to you? When? Where? I am invited to read at Pushkin's apartment in the city I call Peter, and others call Leningrad, on the anniversary of the poet's death. I am going there by night train Monday. Vadim will arrange everything, train tickets, a compartment to ourselves, a place to stay in Peter. You have only to make yourself free. Is such a thing possible? Ben slipped a hand under her fox fur piece and grazed the skin on the back of her neck. She turned, and they sat there with their foreheads touching. Switching back to Russian, Aida said, I read recently where the Egyptians believed that 2 holy fish swam before the prow of the sun god's ship to guide it clear of shoals. The story must have made a deep impression on me because it explains the origins of a dream I had last night. In my dream, I was swimming ahead of a glistening white ship with a strange flag flying from the mast, indicating it came from a distant country. I was naked, and could feel the warm water slipping along the length of my body in an endless caress. Then, suddenly, I saw that I was swimming through a tangle of reefs that left razor-like scratches on my skin. Bleeding from dozens of cuts, I leapt half out of the water to warn the ship that it was heading toward the reefs. A man on the deck, who may or may not have been you, watched me through binoculars because I was naked, but he either did not understand my warning or chose to ignore it. Just when the ship was about to go aground on a reef, I woke up. How do you interpret your dream? I took it as a portent, though I was not sure of what. Aida laughed under her breath. Maybe I should pay more attention to portents. Then, her lower lip trembling, she repeated the word, maybe, in a harsh whisper. Maybe you should, Ben agreed. Aida pulled her head back and examined his face for clues. Finding once again a riot of emotions, she pushed roughly against the door and fled toward the entrance of the building. The driver glanced at the retreating figure of the woman. You win some, you lose some, he observed philosophically. He twisted around in his seat and reached back to offer Ben a leather-covered flask. Cognac, he said with a twinkle, imported from Paris, France. 3 stars. Did you know it was the Tsar Vladimir who rejected the Muslim faith and converted to Christianity because alcohol was forbidden by Muslims? And who could survive a Russian winter without alcohol? I didn't know that, Ben admitted. So as not to offend the driver, he took a sip from the flask before handing it back. Gunning the motor of the taxi, grinding gears, the driver headed toward the center of Moscow. How could you know about Tsar Vladimir, he said to his passenger, you being an American and all? Ben sank back into the seat. How did you know I was American? The driver cackled. I may not speak American, but I recognize it when I hear it. Chapter 10. In a dilapidated hunting lodge, tucked away in a thick stand of white birches off the Moscow-Kiev highway, 18 high-ranking officers and former officers of the Komitet Государственной Безопасности were winding up a meeting that had started in the afternoon and dragged on until the early hours of the next morning. Some of the members of the circle's directorate, as the group styled itself, had made their way from the far reaches of Central Asia and Eastern Siberia for the session. The thick wooden peasant table around which they sat bore the ruts and furrows of the thousands of cutlets that had been hacked away from the bone on its surface. On this particular night, the table was littered with half-empty bottles of mineral water, and empty dinner plates, and ashtrays brimming with cigar and cigarette butts. At 2 a.m., an electric cuckoo clock on the wall struck the hour. A small wooden grizzly bear wheeled into view on the clock's face and reared up on its hind legs several times before disappearing into the bowels of the clock. Distracted for a moment by the grizzly, the participants turned back to hear the end of a story. I was told it happened during a meeting of the Soviet of People's Commissars right after the revolution, a man with sickle-shaped sideburns was recounting. Lenin slipped a note to Felix Dzerzhinsky asking how many counter-revolutionists were actually in prison. Dzerzhinsky jotted down the number 15,000 and passed the note back. Reading it, Lenin screwed up his face in what Dzerzhinsky took to be a sign of displeasure and marked an X next to the number 15,000 to indicate he had read it. You have surely heard the story before. No, never. Absolutely not. Finish it. When the meeting broke up, Dzerzhinsky retrieved the paper and noticed the X next to the 15,000. He immediately issued orders for the prisoners to be shot. Good riddance to bad rubbish, the old general chairing the meeting remarked in a gravelly voice. He waved a deformed hand to dispel the smoke that had seeped into the room from the joints of a wood-burning stove. Dzerzhinsky understood the adage impossible to make an omelet without cracking eggs. It is a lesson our present crop of leaders has forgotten, noted the retired party ideological commissar from Uzbekistan. It is not possible to govern a country as vast as Russia once you have lost your nerve, agreed a younger man whose photograph had appeared in Pravda 2 days before above an article announcing that he had been purged from the Central Committee Secretariat. For all this talk of glasnost and perestroika, the great helmsman has committed a great many blunders, Viktor Prosyenko, the directorate's newest member, chimed in. He lost Eastern Europe for us. He opened the road to German reunification and the creation of a Fourth Reich. He slashed military budgets, leaving us at the mercy of the capitalists who henceforth will negotiate from strength. He undermined a planned economy without providing a workable alternative. He opened the door to the dismantling of the Soviet Socialist Union through secessions. He abandoned the constitutional clause giving our Communist Party the monopoly of power and opened the door to the dismantling of the party through so-called free elections. If he were a paid agent of capitalism, declared the head of the Directorate's Siberian cell, he could not have done more to undermine all we have fought for, all we have sacrificed for. He has raised expectations, the old general said. He will be vulnerable when the masses understand that he has not delivered on his promises. We must bide our time, consolidate our strength, meticulously prepare the terrain for the return of the status quo ante when the pendulum swings in our direction. The representative from Leningrad went around the room passing out tiny glasses filled with home-brewed apricot liquor. Everyone stood and looked at the old general, the directorate's eminence grise. To pamyat, the general announced solemnly, raising his glass. Our time will come. To pamyat, echoed the others. Our time will come. Throwing back their heads, the 18 members of the pamyat directorate tossed off the burning alcohol. Driving back to Moscow on narrow back roads that were unlikely to be patrolled, Viktor watched the headlights sweep across the dirty white bark of the birches at each curve. The old general, his head nodding with drowsiness, slouched next to him in the passenger seat. The more Viktor saw of the general, the more he was impressed by the resemblance between him and his daughter, Viktor's wife, Yekaterina. They were cut from the same bolt of cloth, this father and daughter. They had the same way of flaring their nostrils when they sneered, the same plodding sense of caution, the same willingness, when they thought the odds had shifted in their favor, to fling caution to the wind and gamble. Where are we? The old man mumbled in the shadowy darkness of the car. We will hit the ring road in another 5 or 7 minutes, Viktor replied. He shifted down, then rounded a curve and shifted up again. What do you think the chances are that the pendulum will swing in our direction? The old man pulled an enormous handkerchief from a jacket pocket and smothered a hacking cough in it. Out of the corner of his eye, Viktor could see his slight body heaving even after the sound of coughing had ceased. 50-50, the general finally managed to mutter. Thinking out loud, he added, it was Stalin who formulated the rule of thumb that an enemy had to be eliminated politically before he could be eliminated physically. That is the essence of our problem. How to eliminate the great helmsman politically, how to discredit him in the eyes of the masses, so that his physical elimination will pass almost unnoticed. The mother-of-pearl lights from the first in an endless string of suburban housing projects flickered invitingly on the horizon ahead. How? Viktor inquired. But the old man's head had sagged heavily against his chest. Had he dozed off, Viktor wondered, or was he avoiding a question to which he had no answer? Yekaterina, who slept with plugs in her ears and blinders over her eyes, didn't stir when Viktor tiptoed into their bedroom. The clock on his side of the double bed, visible in the light coming from the open bathroom door, registered 5 to 4. He undressed quickly in the bathroom, opened the medicine chest to hunt for some dental floss, shook his head at the number of jars and tubes, most of them manufactured in the West, his wife had managed to accumulate. It occurred to Viktor that the greater danger posed by the great helmsman was that he might succeed, that he might bring the West with its skin lotions and hair dyes and facelifts and eyeliners and nail polishes and vaginal deodorant sprays to the East. Russian airwaves were already polluted with the noise of Western rock music. Young girls who 2 decades before would not have been seen in public in anything except skirts now strutted around in obscenely tight blue jeans. Young men let their hair grow to their shoulders. Back in the '50s, the militia would have carted these long-haired hooligans off to the local station house and sheared them like sheep. Now good-thinking people shrugged as if young women in tight jeans and young men with shoulder-length hair were the wave of the future. What the Pamyat circle was fighting for, Viktor grasped, was nothing more or less than the purity of the Russian soul. He had not mustered as much enthusiasm for a cause since he had lied about his age to get into the Red Army during the Great Patriotic War. He had put his life on the line for Greater Russia then. It was only fitting that he do so now. Viktor padded on bare feet into the bedroom and stared down at the still body of his wife, folded into a fetal position under the electric blanket manufactured in Germany. He knew she slept naked, and for a fleeting moment he was tempted to slip under the sheets alongside her, glide a hand between her thighs, press the erection that was forming at the mere thought of her nakedness into her buttocks. But he understood from bitter experience that she would whine at him for wakening her before she had had her 9 hours of beauty sleep, would sulk for days, would disappear for auditions or dubbing to punish him. For the last several years, the sexual activity that could be coaxed out of her had only been available on her terms. All that would change when she discovered that he had joined her father in the glorious struggle for the soul of Russia, when that struggle was crowned with success, when he was rewarded for his contribution to Pamya, as the old general had hinted, by being named head of the Komitet Государственной Безопасности. Ticking off items in his report, Frolov's usual droning monotone was filled with eddies of exhilaration. I had a man selling hazelnuts, he was saying. I had a woman selling parsley. I had 17 people on foot, all told. I had 3 teams in radio cars. I had a photographer hidden in a bread truck. He pushed a sheaf of enlarged photographs across the table to his chief. The one on the top of the pile, dark, grainy, showed Bassett and the Zavaskaya woman walking arm in arm under a street lamp, deep in conversation. It is only the beginning of February, Frolov complained, a frown distorting the pear shape of his face, and I am already over the limit on my first quarter budget. We will find the money, Viktor said impatiently. He tapped the photograph with a forefinger. What makes you think they had never met before? My operative covering them inside the Druzhba Cafe recognized her and went over to their table to ask for an autograph. She was taking a big chance, Viktor commented. It was a natural thing to do, and thus within our guidelines, Frolov insisted. As she was leaving, she heard the American ask the Zavaskaya woman if she was famous. This indicates that he did not know her personally or by reputation, that it was a first encounter. If it was their first meeting, Krostin, his head nodding eagerly, asked, How do you account for her kissing him on the steps outside the cafe? They had been talking intently for several minutes, Frolov said. One of my people pushed past them into the cafe. He overheard the American telling the Zavaskaya woman that he hoped they would never meet again. The kiss came immediately after he said this, and was a reaction to his words. The way I interpret it, he was smitten with her, but realized that as an American diplomat involved in some sort of secret work at the embassy, he could not afford to get involved with a Russian woman. How do you explain the second meeting, then? Viktor asked. I am at a loss to explain it, Frolov admitted. We were not tapping her phone line at that point, so we have no idea whether he invited her to read her poetry to the Americans at Spasso House, or it was a simple coincidence. We have no idea what happened inside Spasso House between them. We do know that they left separately, that he joined her as if by prearrangement several blocks from the embassy. We do know that they descended into the metro station together, talking intently. We know also that they sat and talked late into the night in the restaurant on the boat, though we do not know what they talked about. And then, of course, we know precisely what was said in the taxi afterward. From the tape recorder in the pocket of my driver, Zinkievich. Frolov took Viktor's comment as a criticism. You made a point of saying that the American must not suspect he was under surveillance. I had run out of faces that would be new to the American and the Zavaskaya woman, so I accepted your driver's standing offer to work overtime. I was not complaining, Viktor said. When the Zavaskaya woman quit the taxi, Krostin said, there was no more talk of not seeing each other again. Quite the contrary, Frolov said. On Zinkievich's tape, you hear the American asking if he can spend the night with her, and you hear her response, which is in English. She says she will arrange it when she goes to Leningrad for the Pushkin business. Which brings us to the Pushkin business, Viktor noted. We have 3 days in which to prepare the ground. This ought to give us enough time to find out which sleeping car they will be in and plant a microphone in it. Frolov, you are to take personal charge at the Leningrad end. Lay on as many teams as you need without worrying about the budget. Bring people in from Kiev if you require fresh faces. Needless to say, I will want photographs. Making his way down the corridor to deliver an initial report to the old general, Viktor turned to Krostin. Were you able to find out what the American did during his 4 months in Prague? Krostin shook his head. As he was a bachelor, our Czech friends routinely dangled a woman under his nose, a former ballerina, I was told, with a lean body and jet-black hair down to her waist. Apparently, he never batted an eyelash. What he did during his tour at the embassy remained a mystery. What about the Zavaskaya woman? She lives with a husband, a father, a son. Krostin stopped talking as they walked past a group of younger officers chatting around a water cooler. Looking at the officers, Viktor was struck by the gloomy paleness of their faces, the absence of a gleam in their eyes, the lack of any note of excitement in their voices. Morale at the center was at an all-time low. Recruiting, Viktor knew from the old general, was lagging. Officers were dying or retiring or simply quitting faster than the center could replace them. A casual stroll through the labyrinthine corridors of the massive building revealed dozens of offices sitting empty. Slowly, inexorably, the KGB was being reduced to a shell. Only a startling triumph could reverse the slide into oblivion. The Zavaskaya woman's husband is known to you, Krostin continued in the same dispassionate tone. He goes by the name of Vadim. He is the one you had us work up a dossier on 2 years ago. Viktor glanced quickly at his section chief, but Krostin's face revealed no hint of smugness. You will remember that this Vadim, Krostin continued, is in the business of advertising, but seems to be something of a wheeler dealer on the side. He owns a dacha at the edge of a lake near Zagorsk. He is said to have a vast amount of cash available, some of it in hard currency. He hires a taxi by the year and pays the driver partly in rubles, partly in dollars. It was this driver your man Zinkievich was standing in for. The notary registry lists Vadim as a part owner of that cooperative restaurant on the boat. According to the lady who shares the apartment with the Zavaskaya woman, she and her husband have not slept together for years. The Zavaskaya woman has been heard to say that she and her husband are planning to divorce as soon as he is able to move into an apartment of his own. Viktor stopped before the thick oaken door leading to the old general's outer office. What have you got on the father and the son? The father is old and confined to his room. In the early 50s, he was a member of Stalin's personal bodyguard, but was expelled from his interior unit when it was discovered that he was harboring a White Russian admiral. He was questioned several times by one of our interrogators, but refused to confess to anti-party activities. Because of the heavy caseload at the time, the procurer never got around to arresting him. When Stalin died in 1953, the affair was quietly dropped. As for the son, he is age 11 and has some sort of medical problem. I am still trying to find out exactly what it is. Krostin lowered his voice to a whisper. His pointed blonde beard fluttered with excitement. Aside from those Marine guards, we have not had an American diplomat become seriously involved with a Russian woman for decades. We must play them both as an angler would play a salmon, Viktor cautioned. We must give them plenty of line, let them run with it. Only when they are seriously hooked can we begin to reel them in. In the old general's inner sanctum a few minutes later, Viktor informed his father-in-law, I think we may be onto something big. Chapter 11. At 1:15 in the morning, the night train for Peter, as Aida called Leningrad, crept out of the old station on Kalanchevsky Square, her name for Komsomol Square, and shunted one way, then another, meandered through a tangle of tracks etched in the shimmering blanket of snow covering the marshalling yard. As the long train rounded the first great curve, Ben, his forehead touching the icy pane of the compartment window, could make out a shadowy figure standing on the lower step at each door in the cars ahead and behind. Each of the figures swung a hurricane lamp back and forth in a signal of departure. As the train straightened, the chain of lights blinked out. Gradually, the tracks narrowed from 15 abreast to 10 to 5 to 2. The train, swaying rhythmically underfoot, picked up speed. Fields of snow stretching to a penumbra slipped past. Aida, gazing out the window next to Ben, her arm draped lightly over his shoulder, said quietly, "We are being squeezed out of Moscow like dental paste from a tube." As she spoke, her breath fogged the pane. With the tip of the finger on which she wore the agate ring, she reached up and wrote a message on the fogged glass. It said, "Lucidity must yield to lust." Ben turned and pulled her to him, and felt the softness of her breast against his heart. Then his lips touched hers, and lust, mounting like sap from the soles of his feet, asphyxiated what was left of lucidity. After that, he lost track of the sequence in which things happened. Had her clothes fallen away from her body before or after he lifted her weightless off the ground and buried his face in her chest? Had she whispered something about settling like a butterfly on the leaf of his lip before or after she shook free the dirty blonde braid that tumbled halfway to her waist and brushed his body with her loose hair? When had he become aware of odors? The rich, ripe, snow-soaked wetness of his sheepskin overcoat swaying from a hook on the back of the compartment door, the sour staleness of the hot air coming from the heating vent, the sweet acidity of her secretions. Was it before or after he pushed her onto her stomach and breathed disjointed declarations of eternal lust into the sweat-damp nape of her neck? When had he become aware of sounds, the almost human voice of the ties echoing under the wheels, her half-gasps that were transformed into half-moans when she exhaled, the shrill whistle of the wind when she lowered the window and let it snow onto her feverish face and breasts? Was it before or after the pace suddenly changed from the wild flight of electrons to the slow wheeling of galaxies? At length, breathing hard, they backed away from each other like two prize fighters between rounds. She nicked a tangerine with a fingernail and peeled away petals of skin while Ben memorized the soft rise and fall of her heavy breasts. She handed him wedges of tangerine. Sucking on a wedge herself, juice trickling down her chin, she said, "Akhmatova once spoke of a moment of happiness so intense she wanted to carry it with her like baggage through the rest of her life. For me, this is such a moment." She held up a warning palm. "Above all, do not spoil it by feeling you need to respond." Ben whispered, "For me too, this is such a moment. I swear it." Kneeling on the bunk, her weight on her heels, her eyes fixed with an animal's intensity on his, she parted her thighs and reached with the last wedge of tangerine to perfume the lips of her vagina, murmuring a line of Akhmatova's, "And I was bold and bad and gay." She sank back as he came toward her. In the early hours of the morning, the train crawled across a flat, still winter wasteland. In the train, Aida and Ben raised the shade and stood naked at the window, staring out at a distant cluster of one-story wooden houses lost in the black, snow-encrusted landscape. From one chimney, a thin pencil line of silver smoke spiraled into the sky. Aida toyed with a ring on her finger. "This is Dostoevsky's Russia, the Russia of the yellow light of oil lamps, of mirrors and walnut frames, of rustling skirts." They were still peering out the window when the train jerked to a stop at a small station illuminated by naked electric bulbs strung on wires between poles. Steam from the engine scoured the deserted platform. From somewhere up ahead came the sound of a trainman testing the brakes with an iron bar. Pulling out of the station, the train crossed a rusting railroad trestle spanning a frozen river and sped on through vast stretches of birch forests. In the compartment, Ben and Aida stretched out on the cot, their foreheads touching, their limbs braided as her hair had been braided, whispering and dozing and making love, and whispering and dozing again. Shuffling awkwardly through the crowded rooms of Pushkin's flat at number 12 Moika Quay in backless felt slippers fitted over his L.L. Bean boots, Ben was hard-pressed to keep up with Aida, her fox fur piece flying like a pennant from her neck, her head high, her eyes shining. She skated on her own slippers through knots of people, shaking hands, pecking at cheeks, exchanging greetings with the poets and poetry lovers gathered to celebrate the anniversary of Pushkin's death at the hands of the Frenchman Dantès. Reaching back, she grasped Ben's wrist and pulled him into Pushkin's library. After the duel, she told him, they carried him back here and laid him out on that couch. This was his favorite room. The Turkish saber on the wall was a memento of the Caucasian campaign. The figure in the portrait there is the poet Zhukovsky. The inscription is well known. to the victorious pupil from the vanquished master. Townspeople, hearing Pushkin had been wounded, mounted a vigil on the quay outside. Every day at noon the doctors would write out a medical bulletin and post it on the front door. Pushkin suffered excruciating pain for 46 hours. Just before the end, he was heard to say, "Life is finished. It is difficult to breathe." When his heart stopped beating, one of his friends opened the face of the clock and stopped time. You can see the hands are still set to the hour, to the minute, of Pushkin's death. 2:45 in the afternoon. Aida's lips grazed Ben's ear, and she whispered, "So, Pushkin thought that lovers constructed walls of words to shut themselves off from the world, that they communicated in a shorthand of coded phrases and glances and touches, that the absence of a look when there should have been one became a secret message. Shall we build a wall of words to shut ourselves off from the world, dear heart?" Before he could answer, a stout woman who seemed to know Aida elbowed her way through to her and planted a moist kiss on each of her cheeks. "I only came because I heard Zavatskaya was reading," she gushed. The woman eyed Ben curiously. "Aren't you going to introduce me to your friend?" she demanded with a sly smile. "No," Aida said flatly. The woman seemed to find that funny. "You are a queer bird, Aida Ivanovna." In a corner of the library, an elderly man was helped to climb onto a metal chair. "Friends," he called in a feeble voice. The people crowding into the rooms quieted down. "We are come together," the old man announced, "as we do every year on the 10th of February, to pay homage to our beloved Pushkin, the poet who could burn the hearts of men with the word on the anniversary of his death. This year, as every year, the words of Pushkin's friend, V. Odoyevsky, float in the air." The elderly man shut his eyes and angled his head toward the ceiling as he quoted, "Our poetry's sun has set. Pushkin has died, died in the prime of life. We will begin by observing a minute of silence at 2:45, the moment of his death. Then we will have his verses read by several of our poets." A man with alcohol in his breath edged closer to Ben and whispered in English, "Is this your first time at one of these things?" Aida, suddenly alert, angrily asked, "Why do you talk to him in English?" The man looked agitated. "I only thought..." Before he could finish, Aida was pulling Ben away. "What's the matter?" he whispered to her. "I do not like the look of him," she whispered back. "I do not like it that he spoke to you in English without knowing you." Ben glanced over his shoulder. The man who had addressed him in English had melted into the crowd. The poetry readings began immediately after the moment of silence at 2:45. Aida was the third to read. Climbing on the metal chair, gazing out at the sea of faces, she recited Pushkin's unfinished poem, Izhevsky, which ended with the lines, "Where in the tower room long forgotten, grass grows as in a wilderness." After the ceremony, Aida took Ben to see the two rooms in flat 44 of Fontanidom, where Akhmatova had spent the last days of her life. Staring at the daybed in the small room, Aida said softly, "It was here in this room that she gave me the agate ring. She was as white as a sheet, stretched out on that bed. I was 15 at the time. To me, it seemed like a gift from a goddess." As the afternoon waned, Aida and Ben wandered for hours arm in arm through the endless halls of the Hermitage, pausing only in front of the half-dozen paintings that she said nourished the soul as well as the eye. Afterward, they took tea and cream-filled cakes in a new cooperative café off Nevsky Prospect that Vadim had discovered on a business trip the previous month. There was a band and a small dance floor. Leaning across the table, Aida asked Ben in English, "Are you dancing as well as you're fucking?" Flustered, he said, "You are the first woman on this planet to suggest that I am a good lover." She switched to Russian. "We are all good lovers when we make love to people we love." A middle-aged man sitting at the next table leaned toward Ben. "Excuse me, but I could not help overhearing you talk in English," he said in heavily accented English. "I been to Texas, America, to study the techniques of oil drilling. If you think Americans talk funny, you should hear the Americans who are also Texans." Ben, to be polite, asked, "When were you in Texas? Ah, too long ago, the man responded. I would give 5 years of my life to be able to visit Texas again. Their cowboys say things like, howdy, or howdy, in place of how do you do. They got rifles in their cars and throw empty beer cans out the window when they are driving from one place to another. The man pulled a small jar of instant Maxwell House coffee from his jacket pocket and stirred a spoonful of it into a cup of boiling water. He looked at Ben. You are American, no? Can I offer you and your friend a cup of genuine instant American coffee? The band began playing a foxtrot. Before Ben could accept, Aida pulled him onto the dance floor. Holding her in his arms, he could feel the tenseness in her body. He drew back slightly to look at her, but she avoided his eyes. The absence of a look when there should be one is a secret message, he reminded her. Her eyes flicked up. Ben was startled to see that they were brimming with fear. What are you afraid of, he whispered. Of losing poetry, she whispered, of losing you. So, once my father was summoned to the KGB for questioning, he was instructed to bring my mother and me with him. I must have been 4 or 5. The three of us sat across the desk from an officer in uniform. He had shiny gold stripes on his shoulder boards. On the desk was a shiny golden ruler and a jar of instant coffee, which was something I had never laid eyes on until then. He was stirring a spoonful of it into a cup of boiling water as he questioned my father. When we left, my mother and father walked ahead, talking intently. I followed behind them, past the wrought iron fence that surrounded the KGB building, tapping the golden ruler against the fence. My father heard the tap, 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 and saw the ruler and understood I had stolen it from the officer's desk. He slapped me hard across the face and snatched the ruler away from me. That night, he punched a hole in the ice on the river and dropped the ruler through it. Since that day, she finished the sentence with a line from one of Akhmatova's poems. Every sound frightened and tortured me. It was the sight of the instant coffee that brought back the memory. It was also the face of the man. It was him speaking English to you. Ben tried to reassure her. Times have changed, he said. He wondered if it was true. He wondered if they had changed enough. In the hotel room that Vadim had organized for them, they stood gazing out at the Neva. Jagged chunks of blue-gray ice drifted downstream on the outgoing tide. Ducks skidded to a stop between the ice floes and bobbed like corks in the murky water. The battleship Aurora, which had led the assault on the Winter Palace during the Bolshevik Revolution, sat embedded in ice next to a pier below them, blanketed in snow. Icicles dripped from the ship's frozen rigging. A cold haze hung over the city like a shroud, obscuring its spires and domes, making it seem as if time in this northern latitude had slowed. Aida remarked absently, Mandelstam once said that living in Peter was the same as lying in a coffin, but I never saw that side of it. Peter was Akhmatova's lover. Our separation is illusion, she once wrote. You and I cannot be parted. My shadow is on your walls, my reflection in your canals. Aida turned and caressed Ben's lips with the back of her hand as she recited the last two lines of the poem. The sound of my steps in the Hermitage halls where I wandered with my love. She kissed the corners of his mouth and then his lips. We are a perfect couple, dear heart. I am poetry, you are prose. In a few hours, poetry and prose will stand naked at the open window and observe the sunrise. Prose will discover what poetry knows, how the barbs of white light slant in at an abrupt angle, evidence of what I call the city's northness. Prose will discover the odor of the seas surf-breaking out there beyond the perpetual fog, as salty as human tears. Ben's fingers undid a button of her shirt, and his hand slid under it to the soft rise of her chest. Would you leave Russia if you could? Never, she shot back. Startled by the question, I am, like Akhmatova, a guest upon the earth. I have many times asked myself why I was invited here, and I have discovered the answer, to compose poetry. It is because I accept this destiny that I also can be a lover and a mother. If I were to leave Russia, I would lose my sense of soil, I would lose poetry. If you were to oblige me to leave, you would lose prose. She smiled solemnly. We would no longer be a perfect couple. In an almost inaudible voice, he said, "Eventually, I must go away from here." Her chin rose imperceptibly. "If you are Russian," she informed him, "you associate happiness with pain. You follow your heart until it breaks." Chapter 12. Viktor, slouched in a front row seat of the small screening room, could hear the old general wheezing through his sinuses one row behind him as the first images flashed over their heads onto the screen. Frolov narrated from the projection booth in his usual droning voice. "Subjects are seen here boarding voiture 4 of the night train for Leningrad," he intoned over a microphone. On the screen, the American Bassett, almost lost in an ankle-length sheepskin overcoat, handed up two small valises to Aida, then glanced over his shoulder in the direction of the camera, which he obviously did not spot, before clambering after her into the car. The camera zoomed in on Aida, her face glowing with excitement, smiling into Ben's eyes. "The Zavatskaya woman," Frolov continued, "can be seen carrying an avoska filled with tangerines." The old general clicked on the microphone next to his seat. "Where the hell did she get tangerines this time of year?" he wanted to know. "The train reservations, the tickets, the tangerines, the hotel in Leningrad were all organized by her husband," Frolov replied. "If he can figure out how to get his hands on tangerines in February," the old general remarked sourly to Viktor, "maybe we ought to employ him." "The Zavatskaya woman and the American Bassett shared sleeping compartment 9, Frolov narrated. "We had a microphone planted under the floorboards of the compartment, but once the train started moving, all conversation was drowned out by the noise of the wheels." The old general tapped Viktor on the shoulder with his withered fingers. "Hell of a place to put a microphone," he muttered in a gravelly voice. "Next thing you know, they will be planting them in the bottoms of toilets. All conversation will be drowned out by the noise of the flushing." On the screen, the scene shifted. An engine with a large red star on the front was entering a small deserted station illuminated by bare light bulbs strung on wires between poles. Judging from the darkness, it must have been before dawn. As the train drew to a stop, steam from the engine swept the length of the platform. The camera zoomed in through the steam to the window of a compartment. Two figures could be seen staring out at the station. Both were stark naked. The woman, slightly taller than the man, was toying with a ring on her finger. "The fact of their nakedness is the first conclusive evidence," Frolov was saying, "that they had actually copulated." "Copulated," the general muttered in Viktor's ear, "is a fancy way of saying they screwed like rabbits." The image changed again on the screen. There were several quick, unfocused shots of Ben trying to keep up with Aida as she plunged through the crowded rooms of Pushkin's apartment, then a shot of Aida climbing onto the chair and reading her Pushkin poem, and another of Ben, lost in a sea of people, looking around absently, as if he expected to spot someone he knew. "This last footage," Frolov explained, as a new series appeared on the screen, "needs no narration. We were able to install a two-way mirror near the bed in their hotel room. As they copulated with a light on, the images are of excellent quality." "Now, that's more like it," the old general muttered to Viktor as the first shot swam into focus. On the screen, the Zavatskaya woman, naked, could be seen hovering with total concentration over the American's organ, luring it in increments to erection with her eyes and breasts and hands and lips and tongue, then carefully impaling herself on it. Watching from his seat in the darkened screening room, Viktor felt the blood stirring in his groin. Ekaterina had made love to him like that when they first met on the Black Sea, had hovered over him like a haruspex, summoning erections as if they were spirits that needed to be enticed back from the dead. On the screen, the Zavatskaya woman, her long hair trailing behind her, suddenly arched her spine, then slumped languorously forward across the body of the American. Viktor reached for his microphone. "I think we have seen enough to get the idea," he told Frolov. Instantly, the screen went white, and the overhead lights came on. Twisting around in his seat, Viktor told the general, "What you have seen is the expurgated version. The footage of them making love in the hotel room goes on for 3.5 hours. We have shots of them strolling through the halls of the Hermitage. They tried to keep their hands off each other in public, but wound up touching at every opportunity. We had a man planted at a table next to them in a cafe engage them in conversation. He concluded that they were clearly lovers in full hormonal flight. The American was overheard telling her that she was the first person to suggest that he was a good lover. The Zavaskaya woman was overheard replying, "We are all good lovers when we make love to people we love." "Full hormonal flight," the old man muttered. "That is an interesting way of putting it." "That's an accurate way of putting it." "When?" the general demanded. "When?" Victor did not understand the question. "When will you spring the trap?" "Ah, the trap." "Soon." Victor's wife, Ekaterina, fresh from her bath, her hair wrapped in a white towel, settled snugly onto a corner of the couch, her legs tucked under her body, her arms holding closed the white terry cloth bathrobe whose belt had been misplaced by the maid. Victor fitted the tape into the video recorder and sat down next to her to work the remote control. As the first images appeared on the television screen, Ekaterina almost purred with curiosity. "The woman is exquisite," she declared in a throaty growl. "Who is she?" Victor's failure to respond only stimulated her even more. In recent years, he had on occasion brought home cocaine, pornographic films, even some gadgets confiscated from a Japanese businessman caught in flagrante delicto with a prostitute.
Whatever came to hand that could rouse her from the lethargy she fell into when he proposed sex.
Reaching behind her, he slipped a finger under the collar of her bathrobe and began to lightly massage the nape of her neck. Touching his lips to her ear, he whispered his pet name for her. "Katya, Katya, my own Katya." He knew the videotape was having an effect on her when she did not lean away. On the television screen, a train could be seen pulling into a deserted station. Then the camera zoomed in through the steam and came to focus on two naked figures in the compartment window. Ekaterina breathed, "Tell me at least if they are spies." "The fact that we went to all this trouble to photograph them speaks for itself," Victor told her. He began to ease the robe off her left shoulder. The shots of the woman working on the man's organ with her hands and breasts and mouth and tongue appeared on the screen. "Oh, oh, oh," Ekaterina whimpered, languorously raising an arm so Victor could slip it out of the sleeve. Half-covered, half-naked, her mouth gaping open, her pale skin shimmering in the light from the television set, she stared at the screen. When the woman in the film arched her spine, Ekaterina arched hers. When the woman slumped forward onto the man, a gasp escaped from Ekaterina's throat, and she slumped forward, too, into Victor's outstretched arms. Sabine Harkenrider buttonholed Manny as he emerged from the post office carrying a batch of letters. Her face was deathly pale. Her tone was urgent. "Mr. Custer, you did say if we had any doubts we should report it and let you decide." Shuffling absently through the letters, Manny singled one out. It was from an old buddy who was the embassy security officer in Prague. He looked up from the letter into Miss Harkenrider's troubled eyes. "Decide what?" he asked. "Decide if it was a compromising situation," she explained. Manny steered her into a corner. The letter he was aching to get at would have to wait until he dealt with Miss Harkenrider.
"Maybe you should start at the start," he suggested.
"I hope you won't think I'm hallucinating. The last thing I want to do is make a fool of myself."
"Only tell me what happened."
"It's this way. I've been going every Sunday on the cross-country ski outings organized by the community liaison people. The Sunday before last, I was lagging behind the others, and a young Russian man, actually, skied up alongside me and started to talk to me."
"So far," Manny commented, "it does not sound too ominous."
"He was talking in English," Miss Harkenrider stiffly informed Manny.
"What did he want?"
"That's just it. He wanted me to meet him in Moscow. He said he had been following me for several Sundays, waiting for an opportunity to speak to me."
She lowered her voice to a whisper.
"You warned they would try to plant someone. I forget the expression you used."
"A dangle?"
"That's it. A dangle."
"And you think this young Russian was a dangle?"
"You don't understand. Last Sunday he was there again. I skied off from the group to attend to a bodily function. The next thing I knew, he was skiing alongside me. To be perfectly honest with you, Mr. Custer, he made what we usually refer to as an obscene proposal.
You were quite right to tell me about this, Manny said. Here's what to do. Give up cross-country skiing for a while. If the man tries to contact you again, let me know immediately.
You think he will?
Manny hiked one of his heavy shoulders. Whatever. If he really is a KGB dangle, chances are he'll turn up. If he was just someone who wanted to meet an American, he'll stick to the woods and cross-country skiers.
Manny could see the color flooding back into Miss Harkenrider's face. She grabbed his hand. I certainly feel relieved now that I've told you what happened.
Come back to me if you spot him again, Manny said.
Turning away, he looked again at the letter. It had arrived in the morning's diplomatic pouch. Emmanuel Custer, personal and confidential.
Manny slit open the envelope with a fingertip, plucked out the letter, and snapped it open with a shake of his wrist. It began, Manny, old fart. So you're making your last stand in Moscow. I imagine you a smoking colt in each of your paws, surrounded by engines howling for your scalp. Knowing you, I don't envy the one who gets close enough to take it. Re your question. He was as much a mystery here as he seems to be in your neck of the diplomatic woods. He was supposed to be housekeeping, but seems to have spent most of his time in a room put at his disposal by your former employer. Doing I don't know what. As to why he high-hoed off after 4 months, your guess is as good as mine. Probably better. Sorry I can't be more helpful.
Back in his cubbyhole of an office, Manny reread the letter, then ripped it into tiny pieces and let them flutter down into the burn bag. From long professional habit, he appreciated the need to limit access to secrets on the basis of a need to know. Still, there was more here than met the eye. If Bassett was working out of Inkerman's 10th-floor bailiwick, it could mean that Inkerman was up to something. With Glasnost in full flight, there had been a general hold on operations that could embarrass the great Houdini. Was Bassett working for the company? Was the company ignoring the hold order? Was Inkerman freelancing? The truth was that Manny detested Inkerman. He had always seen the relationship between them as a confrontation between old money and no money. Between someone who had been driven to all-male private schools by a chauffeur, in Manny's view, this kind of thing scarred you for life, and someone who had ducked under the turnstile and taken the subway to public school. Manny's instinct told him that the Bassett mystery was worth solving. If he could discover what he was up to, and it turned out that Inkerman was involved, he might be able to take Inkerman down a peg or two before Custer's last stand ended, and he was shipped off to early retirement. The possibility tickled him. Opening a small refrigerator stashed under a table in the corner of his cubbyhole, he pulled out a bottle and the ice tray. Settling back in his wooden chair, contemplating the usual scotch on the usual rocks, he switched into the lazy drawl he used when he was afraid of being taken for an intellectual and uttered out loud the formula from Samuel Beckett that inspired him every time he ran into a stone wall. "I try," Manny growled. I fail. I fail better.
Chapter 13. Slowly, inexorably, their lives entwined like shoots of ivy twisting their way up the bark of a tree. Through February and early March, they managed to steal several hours together every 2 or 3 days. Once, Aida took Ben to the Novodevichy Cemetery to show him the statue of Stalin's young wife, Nadezhda Aleluyeva, next to her tomb. Nadezhda's marble nose had been chipped off by souvenir hunters. Since then, the statue had been covered with a plastic case to prevent vandalism. A light rain the previous night and then a sharp drop in temperature had left the plastic case coated with a thin film of ice, making it appear as if Nadezhda herself were being held prisoner in a block of ice. "We are all of us prisoners in blocks of ice," Aida remarked when Ben pointed it out to her. Strolling between tombstones jutting like buck teeth from the ground, pausing to read the inscriptions on Gogol's and Chekhov's and Mayakovsky's, they made their way back to the entrance of the cemetery. Aida waved a hand in the direction of the Moscow skyline. The Tsar Peter, sometimes referred to as the Great, sometimes not, humiliated Kuchkova when he moved the court to Peter in 1700-something.
The Kuchkova I love is a jilted woman who has never recovered from the insult.
Ben slipped his arm through Aida's. I am a jilted man. Maybe that explains my affinity for the city you call Kuchkova and I call Moscow.
There is another explanation, she told him. I copied a wonderful line into my journal. It came from a book by the English writer Durrell about how a city becomes a world when you love one of its inhabitants.
Ben regarded her strangely. Do you think I am in love with you?
The freckles on Aida's face appeared to be dancing as she offered him one of her whimsical half-smiles. Of course you are in love with me.
After a moment, she murmured, Being apart is like not having a dose of a drug you are addicted to. She breathed out in frustration, creating a cloud of vapor that shrouded her face.
What would the Americans do to you if they found out about us?
When I arrived in Moscow, the embassy security officer warned us not to fall in love with a Russian.
But what would they do? Aida insisted.
Ben shrugged. We would have to pay the piper, he said in English.
Who is this piper, and what is he being paid to do? Aida asked.
Pay the piper is an expression. It is better if the Americans don't find out. Aida digested his answer. At length, she said,
Maybe we should see less of each other.
Ben grinned. Maybe we should see more of each other. As March progressed, they did manage to meet more often, half a dozen times in a dingy room in a ramshackle hostel that Vadim rented by the year for the use of his out-of-town clients, once in a church that was being restored, once in the dressing room of an actress friend of Aida's while she was on stage performing, several times in out-of-the-way workers' canteens, once in Aida's apartment when the woman who shared it had to hurry off to Kiev to care for her ailing mother, and Vadim was off with his mistress. Together with Sava, Aida and Ben went weekends to Vadim's wooden dacha on a hill overlooking a lake near Zagorsk. The first weekend at the dacha was Sava's first encounter with his mother's new friend. Everyone was appropriately edgy during the ride out in Vadim's taxi. Stop biting your nails, Aida snapped at her son.
I'll stop biting my nails when you stop smoking those awful cigarettes, Sava shot back.
Maybe this wasn't such a good idea, Ben whispered to Aida.
Although Ben didn't admit it, he had mixed feelings about the boy. It was one thing to become involved with Aida, and quite another to deal with someone who inevitably reminded him of his own son, Felix. For Ben, it was like tearing open a wound on which a scab was just beginning to form. Following Aida's advice, he waited for Sava to come to him. The first weekend, the boy seemed to resent the intrusion. He hung back, observing Ben out of the corner of his eye, circling him, edging closer at each pass, but always keeping his distance. I don't understand why you need new friends when you have old friends whom you know already, he told his mother when they were back in Moscow. The second weekend, Sava started to come out of his shell. Clearly intrigued by the new man in his mother's life, he watched in silence as Ben rolled a giant snowball down an incline to make it bigger. Eventually, curiosity overpowered timidity. Is it true what Aida says about you being an American? He called from the porch.
Ben looked up from the snowball and nodded. Have you ever met an American before?
Hundreds of times, Sava called back. Also French, also English.
Sava advanced to the bottom step and squatted. Aida said I shouldn't talk about you to anyone but Vadim. She said she wants to keep you a secret. Ben winked at the boy. I'm keeping you and her a secret, too.
So, have you ever seen a real American cowboy, the kind with beautiful boots and a six-shooter?
Ben kept pushing the snowball through the snow. The ones with guns only exist in movies. Sava took in Ben's answer with wide, serious eyes. He gestured with his chin toward the snowball.
What are you doing?
I'm making a snow woman. That made Sava giggle. Everyone else makes snowmen. Snow women are prettier than snowmen, Ben called. He looked up. I could use some help. The boy shrugged. I never made a snow woman before. Come on, I'll show you how. When the snow woman, with pebbles for eyes and a small cucumber for a nose and straw for hair and two wedges of orange peel for a mouth and two coconut shells for breasts, was finished, Sava stepped back to admire it.
What if we put Aida's funny hat and scarf on her, he suggested.
Good idea, Ben agreed.
Sometime later, Aida, who had gone down to the lake to saw slabs of ice for the Dacha's icebox, came over a rise carrying the ice wrapped in a towel. When she caught sight of the Snow Woman with her 1930s pillbox hat on its head and her threadbare fox neckpiece over its shoulders, she howled in delight. "That is the most elegant Snow Woman I have ever seen," she exclaimed. "Does she have a name?" "She is called Benediktovna," Sava said, converting Ben's name in the Russian style to its feminine equivalent. Ben flung an arm over the boy's shoulder and pulled him closer. Feeling Sava's thin body against his side, Ben glanced up at the sky so that Aida wouldn't notice the tears glistening in the corners of his eyes. The last time he had stood with an arm over the shoulder of a boy, he had been with Felix, waiting for the flight that would take his son back to his mother after a school holiday. Later at lunch, Sava scraped his chair up on the same side of the table as Ben's. "I'm cutting down on biting nails," he told his mother. "I'm cutting down on cigarettes," Aida announced. Spending weekends together wasn't such a bad idea after all, Ben remarked. It was during the weekends at the Dacha that Ben and Aida discovered what Aida called the miracle of morning lovemaking, an achingly gentle coupling before either one was fully awake, when the real world mingled with vaguely remembered dreams. Evenings she would weave her spiderweb of poems. "Softly into the center of me you came, I don't know when. What difference would it make? You became, before I knew you were there, the heart of the matter. I want to laugh more often now, I don't know why. What difference would it make? You don't have to identify emotions in order to have them." And murmur fragments from Akhmatova's "There is a sacred line in human intimacy that love and passion cannot cross." As they lay on a bearskin in front of a roaring fire, when Sava was safely asleep in the Dacha's only bedroom, they would begin the fierce search for ways across the line that Akhmatova said could not be crossed. Some afternoons they joined the blonde peasant boys with rope belts knotted around the waists of their gray knee-long blanket-like coats, ice skating on the frozen lake. Their bodies angled forward from the waist, their hands clasped behind their backs, their coattails flying. The peasants etched great figure eights into the ice, then warmed themselves beside a roaring birch fire crackling at the lake's edge. One Sunday, with Sava in tow, Ben and Aida trudged across fields of shin-deep snow, past clusters of thatched, whitewashed huts set on either side of a single wide, unpaved street, into Zagorsk, which Aida called by its original name, Sergiev. There they threaded their way through a mass of pigeons, past the gleaming white Church of the Assumption, where Ivan the Terrible stopped to pray after killing his son, past the mausoleum of Boris Godunov, to the Church of the Holy Trinity. Inside, a young priest with a flowing beard and long dark hair parted in the middle lay prostrate on the ground, his forehead pressed to the cold stones. "He is being ordained," Aida whispered, as a barrel-chested Orthodox priest sent chants spiraling up with the incense toward the image of Jesus, staring down from the golden dome, and the old women, their heads buried in black shawls, responded in feeble chorus, "He is marrying the church." The idea seemed to preoccupy her. Making their way back across the fields toward the Dacha, she asked, "So, explain if you can, how is it you desire many but love only one?" "What makes you think I desire many but love one?" Ben teased. Sava had run ahead, following the paw prints in the snow of a rabbit. Aida stopped in her tracks. Her eyes teared. In an instant, the tears were transformed into tiny crusts of ice, making her look 10 years older. "I acknowledged I loved you before you asked," she reminded him. "I permitted lust to obliterate lucidity. I gave myself freely without holding part of myself back. I told you that you loved me before you admitted it to yourself. Why do you play games with me now?" Ben apologized profusely. "I have not yet grown accustomed to your directness," he explained. He scooped up a mittenful of snow and rubbed it against her lips, then clumsily tried to kiss her, but she avoided his embrace. He pulled back. "I never before met a woman who exposed herself the way you do," he said awkwardly. "To answer your question, if we desire many but love one, it is probably because desire and love do not have as much to do with each other as we thought. I esteem your answer, she said simply. Up ahead, Sava called across the snow. Come, look, Ben! I have discovered the rabbit hole!
The third weekend at the dacha, Ben turned up with a present for Sava that he had ordered from Stockman's department store in Helsinki. He could see he had made a serious mistake when he spotted the look on Aida's face as he handed Sava the box. The boy glanced at his mother, and only when she reluctantly nodded did he tear the paper away. His eyes bulged as he pulled a fleece-lined denim jacket from the box. Casting dark looks in Ben's direction, Aida told the boy, "It is too important a gift to accept." There was a burst of ardent pleading from Sava. Aida took the boy's hand and led him into the bedroom. Ben could hear Aida trying to reason with Sava and the boy's muffled crying. When the two returned, Sava held out his hand. In it were half a dozen lapel pins. "He will accept the gift," Aida told Ben, "if, in turn, you will accept 2 pins from his collection." Ben carefully selected 2 pins from Sava's hand, one depicting the battleship Aurora, the other Vladimir Lenin. Stretched out on blankets in front of the fire that night, Aida said, "Please, do not do that again. I do not want him to grow up admiring America for its blue jeans." In late March, the first faint thaw filled the Moscow air. Within hours, vendors appeared on street corners selling small brown bags filled with vegetable and flower seeds. Watching a long line of people waiting patiently for seeds, Ben took stock. The KGB had either not noticed that he was having a love affair with a Russian woman, or if they had noticed, the political climate was such that they were in no position to do anything about it. No one had confronted him with compromising photographs and demands for information. He was still putting in a full workday housekeeping for the 7 dwarfs, and an hour or so in Inkerman's ribbon room, which left enough time for him to meet Aida. Manny Custer, passing Ben in the hallway one afternoon, noticed a faraway look in his eyes. The embassy security chief noticed something else, too. 2 buttons pinned to the lapel of Ben's jacket, one depicting the battleship Aurora, the other Vladimir Lenin. Watching Viktor's latest footage in the KGB screening room, the old general leaned forward and drummed his withered fingers against his son-in-law's shoulder. "When?" he demanded in a voice gravelly with impatience. "Now." Chapter 14. The woman who lived in the penthouse over the Moscow River had finally gotten legal custody of her son and departed for Israel. Vadim had moved in the afternoon of the day she moved out. Tipsy from vodka and enthusiasm, he liked to quip that a man should change wives and jobs and apartments as often as he changed underwear. He came around the next morning with divorce papers for Aida to sign. Afterward, he half-jokingly, half-seriously invited her to consummate the divorce. When she politely but firmly refused, he invited her to what he described as the next best thing, lunch in the revolving restaurant atop Moscow's needle-like television tower. To mark what was, after all, an important turning point in both their lives, what could be more appropriate than to break bread in a turning restaurant, he said. He ordered champagne and blinis and caviar and cream, and began to regale her with the latest jokes. "Socialism," he said, biting into a blini dripping with caviar and cream, wagging his head with laughter before he reached the punchline, "is the longest and most painful path from capitalism to capitalism." End of side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.